The Slow and the Lugubrious, in honor of Furious 6. What's the best movie car chase?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with the rainy car chase in James Gray's We Own the Night because it is both understated and super intense.
It's me, David the Seven. I'm going to say the final Grand Prix, including flashback, from Speed Racer.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and while I feel like I should be going into the vault and picking something older like Bullet and whatnot, I can't help but just go with Tokyo, Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift in the Shibuya Crossing drift scene, which will echo in eternity.
There have been recent developments regarding Operation Kino.
This week on Operation Kino, episode 115 for Tuesday, May 21st, 2013.
This has to be the tops, and we will, for those of you listening, be extremely careful, at least during this episode, not to reveal anything about anything.
But then, as I was thinking about the way that J.J. Abrams and the writers of these movies kind of work really hard and feel really strongly about not getting it out there, it made me think about it less from my point of view as an audience member saying, like, what will ruin it for me, and more about their prerogative as storytellers.
There's other films like Heli, which is a Mexican drama that didn't go over so well, but no booze. I guess when in Heli, they light a guy's penis on fire.
Oh, my God.
So I think they were so disturbed that they couldn't boo.
They were shocked in the submission.
Yeah, exactly. So
maybe you should start the booing. You're in France. Do as the French do.
This week, I'm talking about a movie that we have done our best to resist talking about for a little while now.
All of us have done our best. Every person on this earth.
And that is my favorite film of the year to this point, and I can't imagine it being overtaken, although I certainly hope it is, because why would I not hope to see something that I love more? But it's Richard Linklater's Before Midnight, the third installment in what has become, in my mind, maybe the greatest cinematic trilogy ever.
Excluding three of the Fast and Furious movies.
I mean, really, the competition for me is Kieślowski's Three Colors trilogy, or maybe The Human Condition. I'm not sure. But as far as formal trilogies are concerned that have a single narrative through line in a linear fashion, this has to be the tops, and we will, for those of you listening, be extremely careful, at least during this episode, not to reveal anything about anything, which is usually par for the course.
Which is going to make talking about it great.
Right. But we're going to talk about it vaguely, but we're not going to be doing a review segment on it, so this is, for all intents and purposes, going to serve as the review. But suffice to say, and I think anyone who follows me on Twitter has probably heard me talk about this ad nauseum, I think it is so wonderful and in many ways perhaps my favorite of the trilogy. I think it is a very natural progression from the first two. I will not say anything about the circumstances under which the film takes place, other than the fact that, you know, these characters are 9 years older than when we last saw them at the end of Before Sunset, and a big question mark was sort of hanging over the air.
Maybe the ballsiest cliffhanger ending ever, especially given that there was no way of knowing.
Although,
that we had no idea they were
going to
make another one.
I would say. I mean, yes, it was very ballsy. And I might get the sense that, you know, it was much more likely that they would make a third one than it was that they would make a second one. But I do think, looking back on it, that we can edit this out if it does feel spoilery, but I don't think that there was much of a cliffhanger to the end of the second one. I do feel like that Ethan Hawke had, his character Jesse had made the decision to stay there and be with her. And there was really no going back from that decision for him. And so I feel, to some extent, however that may or may not inform what we see in the third one, I feel like that's true. But anyway, this one, they're a little bit older. They're obviously, we saw the young, sort of infatuated love in the first one, and a slightly more wistful and desperate love in the second one, and romantic love in all its forms. And what a portrait of romantic love in all stripes and times of one's life and how it sort of evolves over the course of
time. Are you avoiding the word mature because it's coming up here?
Yes.
Okay.
I think that this is probably the most realistic of the films.
Yeah.
And I think it is certainly much harsher than the previous two. There's one extended sequence towards the end of the film, and the film is, while not shot in real time, does take place over the course of one day. And it feels like a nice hybrid between the first two in that regard, and that there are really, it's five major sequences strung together with a few bits of connecting tissue.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say maybe the last half takes place in real time, close to it.
Close to it. I mean, there's like, there are a few little ellipses from time to time,
okay,
but it's almost the sequences, really. It's not, you know, we were having a 5-minute scene and a 2-minute scene and three. I mean, these are like 15, 20-minute scenes, very theatrical in that regard. And something that I paid close attention to when I saw it the second time was how Linklater used the camera to really, you know, to make this a cinematic experience, and rather than something that you might be able to see performed on play on stage. Because that would seem to be possible. And I think while he doesn't want to be particularly showy, I think his use of space, particularly in the extended conversation to which I'm referring to, which anyone who's seen the film will know, and for me sort of evoked Godard's contempt. And that's certainly not a spoiler, other than you have two people who are not necessarily in their best moods. But, I mean, I think it's such a... I posted something on film.com today that some other people have written about, arguing a great debate between which is best, Before Sunrise or Before Sunset. And it's a fun conversation to have, but I think ultimately it can only be so contentious because these films all mutually enrich one another. And I think I was so nervous, as many people must be, for this third film, because it has this potential to really undo what's come before. And while you'll always have those movies, this feels like something that happened to these characters. So it would really be impossible to watch the previous films that are removed from what you see here. And I was, you know, both relieved and elated that it just paints such a wonderful and humane and so well realized picture of where they're going, and most importantly, as I think the case with every film in this series so far, sticks the landing.
Yeah,
that was what I was most nervous about more than anything else. Because even if there are moments that, you know, may not, there are very few moments in this film which did not work for me. But even if there were, you know, it can all sort of be swept under the rug. But the way that these movies end is of paramount importance, and you'll know just by a basic understanding of film grammar when you're seeing the final shot. And when the final shot begins, I was not necessarily convinced that I had gotten there quite yet. And over the duration of this not especially long final shot, things are said and things happen that are just so, so perfect.
There's something about the final shot, and I'm going to try and talk about this again without revealing what's happening there, but unlike, I think, I mean, you would argue that in Before Sunrise, his choice is clear. I mean, this ends with a little bit more finality than that, but it's also about making a choice. It's about kind of looking at someone and like thinking about the way that your life is and kind of getting out of your own head and making a choice about where you'll go forward, in which a lot of what your life is hinges on something relatively small. And I think that the way that it recognizes the smallness and the hugeness of a moment like that speaks so well of why these movies work so well when they're just two people in a room or on a street talking.
And I think ultimately what makes this chapter so uniquely vital to this franchise is that it really is about something that the other two are not, maybe the second one is in a way. But for me, this movie was really much about how our lives are not our own. And
that's very Cloud Atlas of you.
Yeah, I mean, it's rendered in much more relatable terms, and I think practically applicable terms than Cloud Atlas. But just as by way of wrapping up, I think that that's the major theme of this movie, and how our lives can be intertwined with one another's, and how you see that bit of control and freedom, and how you reconcile that with the other people in your life, and I think it's handled so beautifully. I really think that this is easily the best film I've seen so far in this. You know, we're not even halfway through the year, but one of my favorite films I've seen in my life. So
it's pretty amazing. I mean, I'm not you've done basically all the gushing anybody else needs to do, and I'm more of a newcomer to the Before trilogy, which made it really interesting for me to see how wrapped up I was in them, having not seen those movies all that long before I managed to see Before Midnight. And I think that again speaks to the power of these trio of writers, and it's the kind of thing that you see and it makes it look so easy. You're like, oh, you can just follow this couple and see what happens to them as they talk to each other for a while, and then you've seen so many movies that try to do the same thing terribly, and it makes you really marvel at the talent that they bring to this, even though it doesn't show any of the seams. It doesn't show you how hard they're working to make it happen.
So should I look forward to the prequel trilogy?
Yes. It'll be about the building of the railroad that gets to Vienna and how it all began.
Because we have a little bit more time in this segment than I thought, that watching the changes in these characters and the performances over the course of three movies has been really interesting. And I think without revealing anything, I can say that Julie Delpy's character, Celine, which I'm told by those in the know, sort of reflects Julie Delpy in the fact that she's kind of off her face. in this movie in particular, she had like a very sort of exotic sort of vitality to her in the first one, and I think she played that dream girl coming at it from the typical male perspective very well. And here she's a little bit off a rocker, but I think that the character, and there's something I struggled with the first time, because I felt watching this movie for the first time that she was something of an antagonist, which did bother me a little bit, because I thought that the movies to this point had been so fair between the two characters. But watching it a second time, I realized that she is really the truth teller in this movie, and that Ethan Hawke's character conflates falsely the idea of being calm with the idea of being correct or being the rational one. And I think that one of the reasons that the movie works so well is really because – and one of the reasons that these people work so well is because I think no matter how it may look on first blush, your perspective – both are valid perspectives that these characters have for one another, and that they are complementary. And so I think that ultimately that one reservation I had with the movie was solved by watching it again.
I think that everyone can take your recommendations and look forward to this. I mean, along with the recommendations of everyone else on Earth. You're not the only one who's head over heels for this. But
oh,
I love it here. I love it when David falls in love with something, because that meant
it's rare.
It's fun. No, it's not rare. It's just satisfying when it happens.
Sometimes it's about fighting robots, and I could relate. Other times, I waste my punchline.
Darkness is out there, and we have spent all this time talking about what's a spoiler, what's not a spoiler. In our review last week, we kind of just had to go for broke to be able to discuss the movie. And I have gone back and forth on how I feel about spoilers for a long time. I tend to try to avoid spoilers without getting too bent out of shape about it, if just because that's what my job requires. It is a lot of writing about rumors, and when Latina Review tells me that there's going to be action sequences in Iron Man 3, I have to report about that. Some people enjoy ruining spoilers.
Is that how we're going to talk about?
Well, no. I feel kind of ambivalent about what a spoiler means, and to go ahead and talk about Star Trek Into Darkness, having a strong position that Benedict Cumberbatch was Khan in Star Trek Into Darkness did not damage my enjoyment of the movie. But then, as I was thinking about the way that J.J. Abrams and the writers of these movies kind of work really hard and feel really strongly about not getting it out there, it made me think about it less from my point of view as an audience member saying, like, what will ruin it for me, and more about their prerogative as storytellers and how it is their right not to have someone digging up details from their story and revealing them out of context. And that's kind of the angle from which I find spoiler discussion more interesting. Not so much about, like, I don't want to know anything about it, as I want to learn how this story will be told from the point of view of the action, from the way that it's supposed to be told. It's learning the information the way that it was actually meant to be put in the story. And Dave, as someone who defends spoilers at all in all circumstances, it seems. I was wondering how you see it from that angle as a storyteller yourself.
Well, we're coming off a interview that Slash Film did with Kevin Feige, where he basically called out Latina Review and asked, how should we punish these people? And I was like, why are we using the word punish here? Because, I mean, I can understand wanting to keep something secret. And in terms of, like, as somebody who is talking to people in production and sources and whatnot about upcoming movies, I also understand that there are certain things that a movie could hinge on. I don't agree with that, and I would rather know that personally, but I also understand it's not my place to disseminate it.
You would rather know what you would rather know the details of the story ahead of time, no matter what?
Well, if you Google back to my Iron Man 3 stuff, there was a post where I was like, hey guys, Aldrin Killian is the huge villain. The Mandarin is going to be a secondary villain to him. And that was the extent that we were going to say anything about it.
Although you knew that the Mandarin was, in fact, kind of a buffoon?
No, we didn't know the extent that it was going to be that sort of thing. But when this teaser comes out that's showing the Mandarin is like this all-powerful thing, and everyone's like, what are his magical rings going to do? I was pretty sure that none of that was anything we were going to get in Iron Man 3. But knowing stuff like that is all about the execution of the actual movie. So even if I knew that the Mandarin was a red herring, the thing that made the Mandarin so great in Iron Man 3, or the thing that makes Khan a workable villain in Star Trek Into Darkness, is not who they are, but the performances of those people. I mean, Ben Kingsley and Benedict Cumberbatch are the people that make those characters work. And so it's where something like, you know, poor Charlize Theron in Prometheus is just unable to make that character work. And that is sort of a fault of the story, but it's a fault of the presentation and execution of that story, which is what we're judging movies on. So, I mean, I'm not going to say that everybody should be spoiled and everybody should know about Khan. And, you know, what IMDb allowed to happen on their site was gross. And
yeah,
you know,
that was stupid.
Some of the other television broadcast networks, like, letting it out on their air was gross. But I will say that in terms of Star Trek Into Darkness, like, that's not really a secret, which I think is why people felt okay, like, letting it out. It's like knowing who Khan is, they kind of assume that you know who Khan is anyway. So the story doesn't, you know, it's supposed to have this big reversal where it's like, oh, he's Khan. But if you're not a Star Trek fan, you don't know who Khan is any more than a reputation that he's dangerous, which is all the characters know about that villain at the specific point. So it becomes execution problem, not a real secret, which is why Khan didn't bother me.
Yeah, well, Star Trek Into Darkness is a weird example because, I mean, as we talked about in the review, the reveal doesn't really mean that much. But, like, with the Mandarin, if someone had gotten out there, I mean, it's totally conceivable for there to have been someone leaking, being like, oh, actually, he's just an actor. It's a total, you know, dummy character. And that would have really taken away from the punch of that surprise, which I thought was one of the highlights of the movie. That's something that I'm really grateful was not spoiled. And I can think of, you know, it's not hard to imagine, like I said, that being out there. And that's the kind of thing that makes me look at internet spoiler culture and say, is it doing, it's not that I don't think it's doing damage. And you know, the idea of punishing people, I think, is kind of ridiculous, but I do wonder what the value in it is, if it's going to bring up stuff like that, that's going to ruin things for people.
Well, can you think of a movie that is so dependent on its twist that if you had known the facts of that twist, you would have enjoyed the movie significantly less?
Well, I mean, the classic example of it is the classic being 15 years ago, but The Sixth Sense, which I did know how it ended because I didn't see it until like months after it came out. And I still enjoyed the movie perfectly well.
Yeah. I mean, The Sixth Sense is the only M. Night Shyamalan movie that he was able to execute. Well, no. Unbreakable 2. I think he got really, really close to a full execution. But Sixth Sense is like, was birthed into cinema with this plot, with this reversal, but it also has a whole bunch of color imagery, and he also knows how to shoot it. And it's like the one time that you feel like M. Night Shyamalan has control over his movie. So even that movie is about the execution of it.
But there's still a pretty big space between having a movie ruined for you by knowing the twist and just getting slightly less enjoyment out of something that the storyteller didn't want you to know ahead of time. And movies work in a way that not a lot of other art forms do, which is that someone's like, it's hard to spoil a book. Like, it's not very likely that the plot of a book is going to be spoiled unless it's like Harry Potter. And I do think there were spoilers for Harry Potter that came out accidentally and that I wanted nothing to do with. And it puts these people who want to tell these stories in this really tough position where there are these people trying to dig up the details and they have to sell the details. I mean, one of the bigger problems with Star Trek isn't that Khan was being revealed, but that the advertising showed highlights of every single big action scene, which is something that they actually did allow to happen. But that's at least part of the story that the person is trying to tell, and it's more unworkable. And it's the part where it's things that parts of the story that they don't want out there for their own reasons that get out there and then can or cannot, you know, affect the way that you experience the movie, that I maybe have a harder time with.
I mean, it's weird for me when we're talking about like how these things were, they're like the examples we're dealing with now, Star Trek and Iron Man, have these other adaptation levels to them where people, you know, think they know what's going on and therefore have the capability of getting pissed by these spoilers. But I mean, like, even when you think of like, you know, serialized storytelling that has a spoiler element to it, and that's why, you know, they make it to be aired. That's why, you know, they don't make 7 seasons of one thing and then start airing it. Not to mention it would be like monetarily useless, but like Lost.
There's many reasons that we have television the way we do.
Lost and Charles Dickens's Bleak House were received in similar ways by their general audiences, which is that they wanted to know, you know, what the secret is, you know, are they going to finish the Jarndyce case? Is there, you know, there's something in the hatch. Like, that's completely different than a movie that needs to exist as this one individual pod and is about a vision, you know, either a team of creatives or an auteur bringing this vision to screen. It's hard for me to think, like, just because I have the script for Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity and I could know everything, that I'm going to somehow enjoy the movie less, because a 3D movie in space on the page is always going to read that way, whereas the movie is going to be like, that's what you're paying for. That's what you're actually going to see.
Well, I think if you have the script for Gravity and you choose to read it, and that's your prerogative, I think if Alfonso Cuarón were to say, I don't want that out there, I don't want you to read it, that's also his prerogative. And he, like, if someone were to widely publish it and write a whole article about all the twists of Gravity, I think for Alfonso Cuarón to be pissed, he'd be correct to be pissed, because he wants you to experience the story as a film and not as a bunch of words on the page.
I mean, but yes, I agree that that's his right to want that. But what I'm saying is that, like, those things leaking out, it doesn't detract from what you are judging the movie on, which is, are you having fun with this movie?
It depends. Like, you basically, what you wind up having is two Gravities. You have Gravity, the screenplay that you read, and then you have Gravity, the movie. And it can be difficult, just like it's difficult for me to see a Harry Potter movie and not think about the book. If you read a screenplay for something, it can be hard to separate what you read from what the movie actually winds up being.
Yeah, but in this, like, time of where we are, like, basically just doing franchises and reboots, aren't people, the second they hear a title for a movie, aren't they expecting a movie in their head? Which I'm not arguing in favor of, because I think a lot of the people that are sad with the movies they've gotten, Star Trek and Iron Man wise, are being idiots, because
these
are great movies based on the source material. But I mean, what I'm basically saying about spoiler culture, and what to bring it back to what I feel is my most indefensible position, which is the Feige Marvel one, it's like, it's hard for me to see how I should be punished or feel bad for talking to people about things that could potentially happen, and this is the fan base, and I'm able to keep that conversation going for a year, and then your movie opens to $1 billion. Who's mad at who here? I mean, I don't see any sort of hurt in that.
Yeah, and I'm way less interested in figuring out who's winning the battle between Marvel and Latino Review than just thinking about whether or not it's worth it in the end, in terms of how we process stories, not in terms of what gets spoiled, but the way that we look at film as art and how we want the vision of that art to be complete. And if knowing details about it does take away from the completeness of that art, which I'm kind of leaning more toward thinking that it does. And I think that at some point in my life, like, I'm complicit in spoiler culture, and I've come to terms with that. But I do think, if I get to a point where I don't have to be trading in these ideas and go into a story knowing even less, then I'd be probably happier about the way I'm consuming stuff.
I want to give you one thing to think about before we go out. In for someone who takes cinema as seriously as we do, wouldn't the evolving story of what the movie is be an interesting part of the narrative to you? Isn't it like reading a behind-the-scenes book as it's happening?
Sure, but I think I'd probably rather read the behind-the-scenes book after the fact. And it, as much as it is impossible to go into a movie completely blind, I mean, the trailers are also part of that narrative that you're talking about. I think having, like, the less of it before you see it, the better in general, as much as that's an impossible thing to accomplish.
That's interesting. I wonder if that comes from you getting to do a whole bunch of these festivals and things where you have to be the person that is the first person seeing it, and so you don't even have the option, like most of the theater-going public does, of like knowing any sort of pre-thing beyond the marketing.
Yeah. And I mean, and as much as I'm interested in stuff like, you know, behind the scenes shakedowns on World War Z, and as much as I think that's going to be an unavoidable part of that story when that movie comes out, I think the way that I would prefer to experience it would be to know as little as I could. And maybe I'll eventually be able to work toward that goal, even as I continue bringing spoilers to my readers at CinemaBlend, because I am part of the problem as well.
Zombies. So I guess we're going to do a mini segment about Community, because it's just me and Katie, and we're the people that like talking about Community.
That's true. And it is the zombie that can't be killed.
That is true. Although we're still not going to, I'm not sure how things are going to shake out when Community comes back in October with its fifth season.
Can you believe the Community is having, can we just talk about that? It's insane to me that the show has managed to last that long.
Me too, but it makes complete sense because NBC is incompetent fools, and
they're
I think we've talked about, they're on my watch list for being the first network to go under.
Ooh,
as TV starts winnowing itself down.
Well, the fact that, I mean, we only got however many seasons of 30 Rock, which is a show that was way too weird for any other network because NBC was incompetent. So I guess we can thank their silliness for weird shows like Community and 30 Rock.
I mean, a little bit like that, but then it's also people are just watching less TV. I was reading books about the original Star Trek, and like the original Star Trek got canceled with like 20 million people a week. And they were like, oh, this isn't even breaching the top 20. Screw it. And then threw it out. So,
and now Big Bang Theory gets like, what, 12 million viewers, and it's the biggest show of the week.
Yep. Biggest show of television, I believe.
Yep.
But yeah, so Community's coming back. We don't know how or why. There's been some stuff reported on it, like that Dan Harmon might come back, which is false and was something that was floated before Community actually got the pickup in hopes of generating press to get Community picked up.
Oh, wow. That's devious.
Yes, Dan Harmon revealed that on his podcast, Harmontown, in a very hilarious episode where he also delves into race. So by all means, listen to it, but know
was
what you're getting into there.
Was he part of that scheme of the rumor, or did he just know that the rumor was there for that reason?
No, he basically starts his podcast with like, so some of you might have read some interesting things on Deadline this week. And then basically talks about how, like, yes, there was a conversation, but his answer to them was, like, write me back when you have a question. Because they went through, like, side channels being like, would Dan be interested in maybe coming back and, like, doing... And so his answer was, like, come back with a yes or no question and I'll have a yes or no answer. And according to him, he'd love to do it, but they're not going to do it because they've already gotten what they needed, which is a 13-episode pickup, which was to get to syndication.
To 100 episodes.
Yep, which means these... everybody got bonuses, Dan Harmon included, after this upfront pickup, which means everybody's already gotten paid, which means these 13 episodes can be anything, and I think they will most likely be crap, because I heard rumors that the Community cast was being shopped around by their agents as early as last November, so I don't even know who they could get back through the grace of God. Luckily, we're seeing some
You don't think that they have to come back at this point?
Have to come back? No.
Like, aren't they under contract for another season if the show gets picked up?
I mean, I imagine there's some sort of weird contract around it, but Chevy Chase was under a contract for an entire
fourth
season.
He got fired.
Well, I mean, the point being is that they don't need to pay anybody anything, so
true. So they can have just Ken Jeong and have an entire season about him if they want to.
Have you heard How I Met Your Mother's doing for their last season?
Yes, I'm actually really interested in that. I could do a whole other mini segment about that, because I care about that show more than I care about Community.
Yeah, they're going to set their whole season, this is for the listeners, they're going to set their whole season over Robin and Barney's wedding, so there's going to be like 22 episodes about 48 hours.
Yeah, something like that. It's basically like a season of 24, but about a sitcom.
Right. So, I mean, this Community thing's interesting, because I would be all in favor of screw it, let's bring Dan Harmon back for 13 episodes, because that narrative, both as a show behind the scenes and as a show that had to like basically abandon its core conceit for another core conceit for one season, would be endlessly interesting to me. I'm just pretty sure that's not going to happen, because the money's already been made for everybody. So what's the point in
Harmon back is not the easiest route. I mean, he caused all kinds of trauma while people he was working on the show. So why wouldn't they just keep like the more professional, competent people making a worse show?
Yeah, unless those people decided to go on and do something else. I mean, I guess it's probably good that Happy Endings probably isn't going to get picked up by USA or anything. So
why is that good?
Well, because those are the show. Those were the showrunners' previous shows, the new Community showrunners. They could maybe, you know, slink back home and be like, "Hey, we did Community for a season." But now, yeah, we're gonna have to see what sort of deals shape up for this Community fifth season. But I like I've been trying to tell people on Twitter and Facebook is there's a lot of these shows where the showrunner leaves, and the thing that you get is a show, it's just not the show that you fell in love with. Like, The West Wing has 4 seasons, and, you know, 24 has 5 seasons, and I don't care how long it was on the air, what, you know, 24, season 6 and 7, and I don't know, was there an 8th season? Who cares? Yeah. Those are all different shows. They're operating with characters that I don't recognize because they changed something core about them or for themes that I don't care about. And it's not that they're useless, they're just not the thing that was TV alchemy, which was Community season 1 through 3.
Or you can also get something like The West Wing's last 2 seasons with Benjamin Bratt and Alan Alda, which were not the Sorkin years, but weren't that bad either. Like, it kind of overcame its zombie period to become its own thing, which is rare, but it's possible.
Yeah, I'd watch something that was like, you know, the last 3 episodes of season 4 of Community. I'd watch that for 13 more episodes and be fine with it. It's just not the show that I was, you know, frothing at the mouth to try to get back.
Someday someone will write a thesis about how television died, and The Strange Life of Community will totally be a case study in how network television met its end.
Remember the last 3 years of NBC? Here's how it happened.
Because we can! Yes, we can!
Patches, you are currently our correspondent in Cannes, which is a film festival in a place called France, I believe.
I know, I'm 6 hours ahead of you. It's crazy. I know, I'm sleepy, you're energetic.
It's midnight as I talk to you for you and, you know, regular old time for me. I've been watching all of your tweets and posts with great envy as you've been at Cannes for the last few days, as I'm sure everybody else has. We'll talk about the movies for a second. Why is everyone complaining about the rain all the time? Isn't that really such a big deal?
Well, it is, because here's the thing about Cannes. If you've ever been to a film festival, I imagine most of them are the same based on the ones I've been to. Sundance, Tribeca, South by Southwest. Very organized lines. You know when to line up. Everyone is in order, and there's a very strict process. The thing about Cannes is it's structured unlike any other film festival I've ever been to. So not only are there different colored badges, which allows certain people to get in first, and, you know, different lines for different people and an order for how people enter the theaters, but they also force you to stand outside everywhere.
There are no tents or anything? You're just outside?
There are no tents, and there are never gates or anything, or people to keep people in line. So you just have these masses of people, and I don't want to make a generalization about the French, but I'm going to anyway. They're pushy, and people are, it's like crowds, the sea of people are just flooding and pushing and trying to be first in line because the spots in the theaters are so coveted. So let's say the other day I went to see Inside Ewan Davis, and Lewin. It's Welsh. I'm sorry. Lewin Davis. I went to see that film. I have a blue badge, which is, there's white, there's pink with a dot, pink, blue. So I'm a lower tier here. So I knew I had to get there early. Got there 2 hours early. It's pouring rain. This is like monsoon weather. And which is apparently that is not typical of the weather of Cannes. But I'm
sure,
there 2 hours.
Sure, that's what they tell you.
Yeah, right. I'm out there 2 hours. in the pouring rain, feeling horrible about my life, want to see this movie badly. And then, of course, all the other badges start lining up about half an hour before the movie starts. And then they start letting people in, and all of those people get in. And, of course, this is a huge, huge premiere. So about 10 people, including myself, because I was first in line, got into the movie from my line.
Wow.
And this was a huge line. Wow. So because of all these prioritized badges, they get in line. So why does the rain suck at Cannes and people are complaining? Because even though they're in France and having the time of their life, because it's a horribly organized film festival. It's horrible.
That's so surprising. It's such a big deal film festival. You've got these amazing movies premiering there. You've got huge deal filmmakers. You've got these red carpets. It's insane to me that Cannes is, I mean, I guess you're not the priority. Nicole Kidman is. But seriously, what's the deal?
I think, you know, this might be part of French culture. Multiple people have told me because of the laissez-faire attitude that, you know, they don't really think about trying to keep everyone in line. You know, they don't need to consider you. They consider the people at the top and then let everyone else kind of just battle each other to get into the screenings. So it is a torturous, rigorous process, and I'm surviving it this go around. I might be better at it if I come again, but for now, I'm trying to make it work. So
well, so far, are the movies making it worth it? You mentioned Inside Llewyn Davis. I think that's the one that I was really anxious to hear about. Was it worth all of that pain you went through?
I think it really was. I was kind of mesmerized by the movie. It's not what I expected at all. If you've seen the trailers for the movie, you might expect this kind of sweeping look at the 60s folk scene in New York. I guess I kind of pictured it as Llewyn Davis is kind of a Forrest Gump, meeting all these different people and experiencing different things as he goes along his career. But it's totally not that. It's very peculiar. It's not really about anything. It's a bunch of different character-driven scenes from this guy's miserable life. He cannot
miserable,
get his, miserable life. He cannot get his shit together. He cannot be a star. He used to be part of a duo that was very successful, and he lost his partner. And since then, he just sticks to his art. You know, he wants to be a folk singer. He doesn't want to sell out. He doesn't want to do rock singles or anything like that, and he doesn't want to be Elvis, and so his life is miserable because all he can do is get gigs at local New York bars, and no one wants to put out his CDs or his records, his records. And Oscar Isaac is phenomenal in the role because
I'm happy to hear that. I've been really hoping he was going to be great.
But of course, you know, with Cannes, it's always about like who's going to be the Oscar front runners already. And for me, like if you're into that stuff, I don't think this is a role that'll get much attention award season. I personally, because it's so kind of understated and weird and very Coen-y, because he plays the comedy and they play the misery all at once, and it's a challenging role. And I was happy to see Carey Mulligan break out of her usual style. She's a snarky gal in Llewyn's life, and just all again, perfect Coen movie because it has this great ensemble where everyone seems to fit, even though they're really broad personalities, except for Llewyn, who is just kind of drifting through his life. So it was pretty, and again, like the music is fantastic. It has a lot of brother connections, not just because of the music, but because of the way that they traverse through their worlds and how the Coen brothers are able to take an attitude and a feeling that the music evokes and translate that to cinematography and acting and all these different components of a film. So I think it's a perfect package. I had a great time with it. It's a lovely film. That's how I couldn't stop describing it after seeing it.
I am so glad that it lives up to that hype, because it's one of the big things that I've been anticipating. But I also think the point of Cannes is for you guys to come back and be like, here's this foreign film that you have never heard of before. Like when A Prophet came and we heard about Odiard for the first time. And, you know, every year there's something like that. So what's the foreign stuff that that us fancy people or less fancy people won't get to see until like the fall?
Well, that film, I think, is like Father Like Son, a film I actually regrettably have not seen because it kind of came out of nowhere. And it's this I wouldn't call it sentimental, but it's a gentle father-son relationship film. Everyone says, oh, this is the one that Spielberg's going to pick for the Palme d'Or.
Being called like father, like son seems like it's just like a home run right to Steven Spielberg's outfield.
Oh, yeah. So that's going to be huge when it eventually comes out. I am a huge, huge fan of, Ari Folman's The Congress, which we've seen a bits of, I believe, in trailer form. This kind of insane Robin Wright. It's Robin Wright's being John Malkovich. But with like The Matrix and Cloud Atlas and What Dreams May Come and all,
Oh my God.
It's every movie. Every movie.
And this is Ari Folman who made Waltz with Bashir. This is animated as well, or kind of animated?
Yeah, half of it is animated. So in the beginning, I think we've seen in the trailers that Robin Wright basically sells her image to Hollywood because Hollywood tells her that she hasn't made a good movie since Princess Bride and that she's washed up.
Wow, harsh on Forrest Gump. Goodness.
Yeah, exactly, right? And that she'll never do movies that actually sell and that people want to see. So the best she can do is sell. Oh, yeah, totally. And she sells her image to Hollywood and does this whole scanning process. And it seems very realistic because it's basically what we saw in Holy Motors in some ways.
Yeah.
But then it goes this extra step because the animation portion of the movie is actually a real place. It's not like a hallucination or something like that. Think of it as The Matrix, but we're getting plugged into cartoons that allow us to take on any form. We're willingly doing this.
Okay.
And so Robin Wright enters the cartoon world a la Roger Rabbit in some ways and starts, we see the process of selling one's image evolve into something perhaps more dangerous where we don't want to recreate celebrities and put them in any movie that we want. We now want to make celebrities into drinks and food and clothing.
Oh my God.
So that we can now eat and consume them and wear them. And that's kind of where the movie goes. And it's grandiose and it's just colorful and mesmerizing. And it's beautiful. I loved it.
See, this sounds like something like Holy Motors, The Cell, or Cloud Atlas that like some people will fall in love with, but like a lot of people will not be able to deal with.
Absolutely. The reactions are very mixed here at Cannes. There are a lot of people who do not like it. And I also saw it in the basement of a library theater space or something like that. So,
wait, aren't you all supposed to be that, like walking up red carpets and like going up like up these great huge stairs?
Well, that's the thing. Most of the movies are at that center where you see all the glamour and glitz, and then they have some offshoot theaters that I felt like I was going back to my Philadelphia suburb, middle of nowhere, go into the basement and watch a movie projected onto a wall. And that's how I experienced the Congress, and maybe that's not the best way to do it. But
have you been wearing a tuxedo to any of these screenings? It's always been unclear to me who has to wear a tuxedo.
Unnecessary, only for premieres. I wear probably what I wore yesterday because I'm stumbling out of bed at 6 a.m. and getting home at 1 a.m. Never sleeping.
So it sounds like not dissimilar to like Sundance or Toronto or festivals that I've been to, where you're seeing as many movies as you can, you're eating poorly, you just happen to be following French street signs to get there.
Yeah, oddly enough, France does not have much to offer in the way of food besides pizza, spaghetti, and hamburgers, and that seems strange to me. But
no, why weren't you at the big Catching Fire beach party so you could go ham it up with Jennifer Lawrence?
I'm sorry,
fed?
I was at the big.
Oh, you were at the big. Oh, yeah. Oh, I didn't know that.
But they departed very quickly, so it was mostly just people who looked like they were from the Capitol, dressed up serving us drinks that looked like the people from the Capitol. But that's
I'm embarrassed that is like the main headline I've taken away from. I've gotten so many emails about it, and I can't figure out why Catching Fire is at Cannes, except for, I guess, just to get people like me talking about it.
Well, as the director of Cannes will say, in a movie that I saw earlier this week called Seduced and Abandoned, the Alec Baldwin, James Toback documentary about how tried to get a movie financed at last year's Cannes.
Is that worthwhile?
Oh, it's horrible. No, oh. I would never recommend it. HBO is putting it out, and it's real just masturbating. It's just about how hard it is for them to get movies made. They want to make a $20 million movie that's like Last Tango in Paris, but set in Iraq, starring Alec Baldwin fucking Neve Campbell. for 2 hours. And they want $20 million to do it. And the whole point is like, no, we can't put Neve Campbell in a movie and give you that much money. That's like the whole movie.
Wow.
But they do, because it's set at Cannes, it's like a great little inside view into the world of Cannes. And
yeah.
The director speaks about, you know, why do we have all these ads for The Lone Ranger, Catching Fire? It's because we need that to pay for a place to host small movies that Hollywood would never make.
Yeah. I mean, have you been seeing any stuff that's amazing that, like, may not, like, wind up at the New York Film Festival and, like, you know, get the kind of hype that, you know, Asghar Farhadi's movie or Ari Folman's movie will?
I'm trying to think. You know, I think most of these will actually come to, like, they'll hit the U.S. in some capacity. I just read that the director of A Separation.
Asghar Farhadi.
Yes, his new film, The Past, has been picked up by Sony Classics, and that is a phenomenal film.
Is it as good as A Separation?
No, not as good as A Separation. I was just really taken by it because it stars Berenice Bejo.
Artist?
Yes, who I was not necessarily... She got nominated for an Oscar, but, like, why? I don't really understand.
Yeah, nobody knows.
And so I never really regarded her as a great actress, but here she's just blowing up the screen, just chewing up scenery, and they all are. I'm not too familiar with the rest of the ensemble. I think the guy from A Prophet, speaking of that film, is in the film. And it's all this just collection of understated performances, very talky, it's a family drama. In the piece that I wrote about it, I'm just in awe of these performances because they feel like I'm watching Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, becoming Lincoln in some ways, which is a real transformation.
Oh, wow.
And I think that's
all of these performances are on par with that.
I'm not saying they're on par with that, but I got that same gut feeling. You know that mm-hmm. feeling when you see someone kind of just being showy is the wrong word, but we see the acting, we see the transformation. It's phenomenal. He's becoming this person. I felt like I was watching people become these just regular Joe characters,
mm-hmm.
and that's really inspiring. And the twists and turns this movie takes. I mean, every movie should look to the past. As an instruction manual on how to do exposition, because here's a movie that's just like, here's what's happening right at this very moment, and the exposition to fill in the blanks for who these people are and what has happened to them will be kind of rolled out over the course of the movie as reveals, as opposed to just dumping a load of exposition on your lap.
That's amazing.
So that was really exciting. It's you know, I think a bunch of people said it's just kind of like a Young and the Restless type episode. It's just, you know, a lot of bad things happening to nice people. But it's the way it's constructed and the performances really enhance it. So
at this point, you've got a couple more days left in the festival. What are the big things on your list, or maybe the stuff that you're not going to get to see that everyone's really talking about?
Well, I'll end up getting to see a lot of it. Thankfully, I extended my trip. But I'm question marking Only God Forgives because I'm wondering, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of Drive.
Yeah.
But I think taking the action to Japan might be really interesting for Nicholas.
Thailand?
Okay.
Thailand.
To the east.
I think so.
To a vibrant city. Might be really interesting for Nicholas Vending Refn. But again, I'm not.
But that movie will
biggest...
also be out later this summer, so.
Yeah, well, everyone will know soon. And Nebraska, the Alexander
Payne
film. Oh,
yeah.
Obviously, with Will Forte, very high on my list. I love Alexander Payne, so that's a big one. And, you know, a lot of little things that I'm trying to discover while I'm here, balancing seeing the big ones that people want to hear about and trying to dig up some ones that they don't know, that aren't on their radar. Coming up for me, I'm going to see this movie Borgman that people are telling me, oh, it's like Kill List, but the foreign version or something. And I'm like, oh, I'm sold. I have to see it. And of course, we have Behind the Candelabra, which is coming out soon. And everyone will be seeing that
I know.
In no time.
I've set my DVR. I'm counting down the days. To wrap things up, I have one more burning question about Cannes. Do people boo as much as they say, as everyone says they do?
I haven't been to a single boo at the festival yet.
That
maybe I haven't seen a terrible movie. I mean, actually, I have seen a terrible movie. Seduced and Abandoned is pretty awful. And what else is awful? I haven't seen too many awful... People didn't seem to like The Bling Ring very much, which is going to make David upset.
I was hearing some weeks that David is going to go nuts.
But I enjoyed it. I mean, it's very pointed, and it's telling the singular story, and it's doing it like a fly on the wall, but it's very funny. Emma Watson is very funny. But there's other films like Heli, which is a Mexican drama that didn't go over so well, but no booze. I guess when in Heli, they light a guy's penis on fire.
Oh, my God.
So I think they were so disturbed that they couldn't boo.
They were shocked in the submission.
Yeah, exactly. So
maybe you should start the booing. You're in France. Do as the French do. And then you go and eat your pizza, and you have truly had the French experience.
Oui.
That does it for today's Operation Kino. We'll be back on Friday talking about Fast and Furious 6, or Furious 6, if we're going to make that title take off, which I think we should start calling it that. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior editor of Film.com. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich and at Film.com. And while you're at it, that Criterion Corner, too. And I did want to say that you should leave us a review on iTunes. It is easily the best way to give us feedback, and also the best way for us to, especially if you like the show, reach new listeners. So it's always very much appreciated. And also, if you're on Facebook, so are we. We are at Operation Kino, right? Not Op Kino. Operation Kino.
It's Op Kino
on Facebook. And we've been using that more and more, so it'd be great to hear from you there, too.
Well, I'm Dave Gonzalez, and I was going to talk to you about Facebook, but now I guess you can tell me, you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/DA7E, or hey, why don't you type in Star Trek Generations DA7E to your Google machine and listen to me geek out about something I know a lot about on the Wrong Opinions About Movies podcast.
That sounds so much better than a Facebook recommendation. I'm all over it. I'm Katie Rich. You can find me here at Cinema Blend or on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Opkino, where you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in
Dave?
In honor of Furious 6, which I still like fast, but I understand that's cumbersome. What is the best movie car chase?
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you on Friday.
And if he stays, I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm a thousand pieces of light. If he stays, then I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm a thousand pieces of light. If he stays, I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm a thousand pieces of light. If he stays, then I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm a thousand pieces of light.